terms of industrial development. I'm just going to briefly mention who the five speakers are. You have the detailed biographies that you received in your packets, and so I won't go into a lot of detail on their backgrounds, but we have John Commerce, who many of you know. He is with Donjek and also is a member of the Met Council for representing St. Paul. He does economics and strategy consulting in support of redevelopment, and he speaks often and was a recent speaker on this topic at the Revolution National Conference. Jay Demma is from Perkins & Will, and he has done a number of studies related to industrial development, including one for University United on University Avenue Urban Manufacturing, and he presented at the this year's Minnesota APA Conference on Urban Industrial Trends. Peter Remish, who I got a note is running a little bit late, but he will be here hopefully in about 10-15 minutes. He is a developer of a project that's underway right now, a very interesting project called Vandalia Tower Project that's in our West Midway Industrial Area. David Stokes from Cassidy Turley, he specializes in sales and leasing of industrial properties in the Minneapolis-St. Paul market, especially has done a lot of work, again, in the West Midway Industrial Area. And John Wall, who is a developer working on a very interesting project that's just across the border in Prospect Park in Minneapolis called the Minnesota Innovation Park Initiative, which may have some impacts on St. Paul as there's a discussion of sort of extending and branding that district to include parts of St. Paul. So with that, I think I would like to invite John to come up and kick us off. Thanks, John.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks a lot, Donna. Well, I'm really happy to be here. I, as Donna mentioned, was really honored to serve two terms on the Planning Commission. I learned a lot in this room, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity to have participated in that work. I think that the Planning Commission is one of the key places where the rubber hits the road on the issues that we're going to be talking about this morning. And I think about, I'm often asked about the remarkable size of the St. Paul Planning Commission. Mm-hmm. As you know, it's, you know, about three times the size of many planning commissions. And I think, I continue to think that that's such a large strength for the city because you're able to be involved in standing committees and really rolling up your sleeves in the work of planning for the city's future. And I think that that's a really important distinguishing characteristic for our city and for the Planning Commission. I also think that we live in interesting times as far as land use and the evolving urban economy goes. And industry certainly plays a role in that, but it's not limited just to industry. But of course, that's our focus this morning. I have a series of slides that I intended as kind of a very high level introduction and really a gateway for my fellow panelists to really walk through and provide, I think, more detailed commentary about the marketplace. But mine is really intended as I think, kind of an overview. So having said that, I have kind of a way of thinking about the way that places are put together. And it's in terms of layers, and there are seven of these layers that I wanted to mention because I think they relate directly to our topic this morning. If you think about places like the Ford plant site or the Mississippi River as a whole, as it flows through St. Paul, or the West Midway, which I'll be talking about in a little more detail, all of these different layers of place are really critically affected by or have driven the evolution of those different centers of industry. If you think about the geology, the water resources, the history, physical infrastructure, governance, the investment in structures over time, and then also in terms of the interaction and the demography, the way that we're currently using these places, these are all sort of key elements of what comprises a place in the city, and that includes our industrial places. There's more to that if you look at these seven layers and we think about the factors that we're really planning around moving forward for the next 50, 100 years. We're thinking about the climate imperative. We're thinking about a new kind of demand for urban locations. We're thinking about increasing stress both at the state and the federal level in terms of how are they planning and how are they creating partnerships with local decision makers. What is our level of confidence about federal transportation investment, for example, going out 20, 30, 40 years? Everything that we do in the city needs to do more than one thing. And I know that sounds kind of to be a generic comment, but my point is that infrastructure that we put in place needs to play more than one function in order to really reach the efficiencies that we're going to need to plan around in terms of climate, in terms of our fiscal picture. So these arrows that I've added here for porous, transparent, and multifunctional, those are sort of aspirations, I think, for the roles or the functions that are both our public infrastructure and our development needs to play as it evolves in our urban landscape. A couple of overall themes as well. There's a momentum of core investment and population gain that I think in many cases is unfamiliar in scale. It's a really significant transformation. We have a need for mobility, and at the same time, we understand that proximity benefits and the climate imperative and the desire for more choices are really driving an expansion of the transit system. The international landscape for outsourcing has really changed. And finally, manufacturing, I think, is better understood as a gateway to the middle class than maybe it used to be. Some more factors. If you think about the fact that there's really no such thing as a fully built city, and that cities are constantly responding to dynamic conditions that are current. They're not the past conditions, they're current conditions. For us, that means that the nature of industry is changing. If you see the 3D printing, the explosion of that technology, both regionally and internationally, that's such an important trend. The way that we move around certainly is dynamic and in a state of transition. So is the density of our population in the urban core. That's leading to lots of interesting discussion about how we go about creating choices across price points and across demography. Also, the location of our poorest neighborhoods in the region, to take kind of a regional perspective, was just a couple of years ago we passed the threshold of finding that there are more residents living in poverty who live outside of the core cities than who live inside the core cities. And that's a significant planning challenge regionally if we're thinking about workforce strategies, which, of course, is one of our topics today. Some of you know that I've been involved in the work that the Planning Commission began in 2010 in the West Midway. I want to present a little bit of a couple of thoughts about that as a microcosm, as a sort of example of some of the issues that I think are important today. Really, all of the themes that I just mentioned really come together in St. Paul's industrial areas, and I think the West Midway provides kind of an interesting example. If you think about the need for the different kinds of infrastructure, the pressure of a range of market types, real estate market types, with interests in the same physical space, I think the West Midway is a good example of that, but it's not limited at all to that part of the city. These are trends that certainly are citywide. This is a map that you've all seen just of the industrial zone land in the city in purple. And we all know where the West Midway is. This is for a less seasoned audience. But I wanted to just mention this because I think the most significant piece of this is that between 2000 and 2010, both Minneapolis and St. Paul transitioned about 500 acres from industrial use to other uses. And that's about a 15% loss in each case. The West Midway is the largest contiguous area of industrial land in St. Paul. But given the themes that I presented about a moment ago, in 2010, St. Paul policymakers moved ahead with this scope for the West Midway industrial area task force. And the reason I want to put this up is really to highlight this simultaneous emphasis here. The point that the strengthening of the connection between transit and industry alongside efforts to connect residents with both with jobs and with the access to get to those jobs really was front and center for this work. So the notion of it's not an either or, it's a both and, but how are we going to get to a place where our planning can reflect the market's interest in pursuing that kind of strategy. So this next slide is just a visual to talk a little bit about, again, the challenge to the both and strategy. There is a little bit of either or that's implied by some of this market activity. There is the question of, you know, why is there a strategy even required for our industrial areas? You know, let's just let the market handle that. Isn't that what the market does best? Well, the reality is there's a conflict in incentives that has a consequence for the public good that I think merits the work that you're doing here in terms of planning for the future of industrial land in the city. So if you just follow this sort of rubric along, you've got office uses in the West Midway. They have, you know, a quantity of jobs per foot. That's a benefit. Higher tax base per foot, higher gross tax revenue. That's obviously a good thing. And then we've got industrial uses in the West Midway, but also citywide. This is really intended as a citywide comment. You've got jobs that provide a gateway to people with a range of credentialing levels. That's a higher jobs multiplier that comes out of that activity. And frankly, there's a higher revenue service efficiency in terms of the amount of revenue that comes out of the activity versus the amount of public revenue required to support that particular activity. And you're familiar with that dialogue. So I'm going to try to keep moving here. I don't want to get too much more deeply into the West Midway work because you've all seen that. You've obviously, you know, deliberated about it and chosen to move it forward and codify it. So I don't want to get into too much more detail about it. But I think that the point is we have better and better tools to understand how and why industrial areas work in the city. And I think that that's a significant improvement over what we've had in the past in terms of really understanding what are the activities that are happening in these places and why are they there and how do they interact with each other and how do we leverage those connections to make something great happen. And then the next piece, you know, how can we use that data to create planning frameworks that support both the market impetus and the market interest in those places, but also support a public interest in retaining the contiguity of those places and retaining access both for freight and for people to reach jobs in our industrial areas. There's business collaboration that's certainly implied strongly by the work that came out of West Midway, and I think that that applies directly to the health and the future of our other industrial areas in the city. There are also very strongly implied strategic public investments that are required to protect those public interests that I mentioned, and also to elevate and maximize the kind of market activity that will be taking place in those areas in the next generation or longer. I want to make a particular comment about sidewalk priority. I mean, it's a relatively specific strategy, but I think it's an interesting example of a way that on a relatively modest capital budget, and you know, it depends who you ask whether sidewalks are a modest budget, but on the citywide scale, they certainly are, and they're an important way to create a both-and kind of approach in these areas where enhancing and strengthening access for people to move around in these industrial areas is an important priority, and frankly, not something that's always been a priority in our industrial areas. There's a lot of missing sidewalk segments, et cetera, which really inhibits the variety of uses that I think you can embrace in those areas. This is a listing of some resources that were contemplated by the West Midway work. Again, you know, these are familiar themes, strong and sustaining partnership among public, private, and philanthropic sectors, funding for site assembly, infrastructure requirements, et cetera. I think one of the underlying messages is that with these layers of future trends that are underway that we're going to be talking more about and hearing more about from our panelists, you know, the concerted partnership of public and private, I think, is elevated that much more as a priority, and it's something that I think the Planning Commission is well suited to be exploring as you enter the next round of comprehensive planning work in the next couple of years. So just finish with this image of an older and a newer area of industrial use. You know, there's the lower image, I think, suggests how there's a lot of pressure in terms of, you know, there's a lot of desire to use urban landscapes that have been industrial in the past in a wider range of ways. And that's, I think, an opportunity, but also a real challenge. And it's something that, again, I think the Planning Commission is clearly charged with leading the work on. So with that, I will conclude my remarks. I'm looking forward to some Q&A and panel discussion, and also the presentations from our panelists. Thank you.
Good morning. Donna mentioned I work for a firm called Perkins & Will, and if any of you happen to be familiar with that, they're primarily an architecture and design firm. It's kind of their reputation. I am a planner, and in addition to that, I'm a market analyst, and I'm also a geographer. So I'm trying to kind of fit into this organization to kind of add value to work they do. And so I take a little bit of a different approach to things. And so what I'm going to try to do today is give you perhaps maybe a bit of a history lesson. Because being a geographer, there's a thread that always happens through sort of space and time. It's always kind of interesting to understand, particularly if we're thinking ultimately about the future. But before I really get into my discussion, I want to start with this icon. I pretty much just searched on Google, looked up, you know, factory, manufacturing, you know, icon image, and this is pretty much what pops up, or something very, very close to it. And as you can tell from looking at this, this is an enduring image from quite some time ago. Not to say that we still don't have smokestacks that look like buildings like this and still do things and behave in this manner. But this is an old image, and it's an enduring image. So I want to kind of begin my discussion with going back and really understanding why we have this as an icon today and kind of what the bridges are between the past and the future. So I'm going to go all the way back to the 19th century, in part because that's the Industrial Revolution. That's where a lot of our manufacturing history sort of comes from. And it's really, to me, as a geographer, again, it's really about scale. And that's a point in time in which we took from making things, being at sort of a decentralized, almost a household level, to a very, very large scale level, a mass level. And the three things that, there's three important things I want to highlight as to how that came about. The first one is this idea of power. And in the 19th century, we began to harness power. We took water power, converted that to steam, electricity, the combustion engine. We really began to figure out how to really use power in just some really remarkable ways. Now, with that being said, and we were able to harness power on a great scale, we couldn't distribute it particularly efficiently. So to use the power to make things, you still were somewhat tethered to that source of power. So keep that in mind. It's one of the elements of kind of placemaking in the 19th century. The other element is this change in transportation technology, primarily the railroad. It was prior to the rail. It was very difficult to move and ship things over great distances, particularly over land. And then with the railroad, we really dropped costs on how long it would take to move something. For example, I think from New York to San Francisco before rail, it took somewhere 4 to 6 months to get between those two places. After rail, it was 3.5 days. So you can imagine what that does in terms of the amount of time and cost for folks to make things, open up markets, and move things over great distances, particularly raw materials. But even with that increase in transportation technology, keep in mind that rail being your primary network, accessibility is still a big issue. You can't build a rail station every quarter mile or half mile. You got to build them great distances apart. So those stations become really, really key, and they focus a lot of energy and effort. And then the third thing I want to talk about is an element of sort of this 19th century sort of industrialization is people. It took people, lots and lots of people. If we're talking about increasing the scale of manufacturing in particular, you need a lot of hands to make things. And you need a lot of excess hands to actually create a competitive labor market so that it becomes actually profitable for manufacturers to produce things. And at the same time, you also need a market to consume all those things that are made. And this is a period of rapid population growth, and that really converged with those other forces to what I would probably say is that industrialization in the 19th century really creates urbanization as we know it today. All these things sort of come together. It's very nodal, very focused on the city experience. And ultimately, because this change is happening so rapidly, this is part of the legacy that we're left with from this period of time. You know, we were still really capitalizing on all these forces and wasn't always necessarily clear as to what the impacts were going to be. Now, I'm going to move a little bit forward here to get us into the 20th century. And so once we're trying to deal with this 19th century legacy, one of the first things we do in the 20th century is we start to separate ourselves and realize that the negative impacts of large-scale industrialization has on everybody from a health and safety standpoint. So we zone. We separate uses. And that's one of the key characteristics of sort of 20th century industry. And then we innovate on a way that we make the process primarily horizontal. And again, that takes more land. So now you're starting to get a picture here about what kind of brought everything together in the 19th century. We're starting to pull those pieces apart. And then we eventually update our transportation system. We add on top of rail and water systems. We have now a highway system where the accessibility is vastly increased. We can get on and off systems like this every half mile or mile. We can allow our urban areas to spread out in ways that they hadn't been able to before. So again, that's a force that's really pushing industry further out. And then we do containerization. This is important to the manufacturing process because what it does is it reduces the port times for the shipment of goods overseas. So it opens up markets overseas to ship goods. At the same time, it also opens up overseas labor markets to produce those goods and then ship them all over the world. And then at the same time, we're also automating the manufacturing process. So we're not using we don't have as strong a need for lower skilled production based jobs. And again, that globalizes the process. So the legacy that we're left with from 20th century manufacturing dynamics is one in which toward the end of World War II, nearly 40% of the American workforce is involved in manufacturing. Now, by the early 21st century, that's down to less than 9% of the workforce. So in the United States, the experience is such that we just don't need as many people manufacturing. And a lot of that is at the expense of manufacturing that had been historically in urban areas. So we have a legacy now of sort of areas that no longer are doing the kind of manufacturing that had once been there. Now, we kind of know this picture. As a planning commission, you've been dealing with sort of this legacy in St. Paul in particular. What do we do with these areas that were built up at a different time, different era? How do we use them? Many times it's other uses. We consider and we let market forces dictate the opportunities to perhaps do adaptive reuses or new uses altogether in these areas. However, I'm going to argue, though, that there are some forces now that are actually starting to push manufacturing back into an urban context. The first one is that, we go back to that icon of the factory that's belching smoke. Again, yes, it's still around, still happens, but a lot of our manufacturing today is actually a much cleaner process. And the issues of health and safety that we had from 100 years ago just aren't quite present today. So we don't need to, from a health and safety standpoint, separate the uses that we did at one time. So that's one element considering an urban context as being perhaps valuable to the manufacturing process. The other thing is the changes that are happening in printing technologies. I've got these images of the 3D printers that are up there, there's a lot of hype around this technology about how everyone could be pretty much making whatever they need in their home. I think that's a little bit to be seen whether it's going to get to that point. But my point here, though, about what these technologies are doing and revolutionizing the manufacturing process is that they are reducing the barrier to entry through industrial design. It used to be that if you came up with an idea for a product, you had to eventually get the financial backing to bring that to a mass production scale. That's a huge endeavor, and it's a lot of barriers. This technology gets rid of a lot of those barriers. So the idea of being an innovator, an imaginator, an experimenter, somebody who's coming up with ideas that perhaps can create and design a product that could be useful to people, it can happen at a vastly different scale than what it had historically. And so from a geographic standpoint, that's huge. That's a huge thing. It can, the energy that goes into designing and making things then happens not necessarily on a physical level, but it happens more on a intellectual capacity level. There's also important cultural and economic trends that are happening today. Some of these images just highlight the fact that, the idea of made in Minnesota, just locally sourced. The idea of being able to want to have things, food is a big thing that's being locally sourced, but I think all of our products in daily lives are now starting to be more and more sort of locally sourced is a desirable thing. There are sort of green and sustainable and resilient processes that are being implemented in the manufacturing process that are going to perhaps lower long-term costs for the process. And when I say green and sustainable, that means more urban, place-based a process that might make these more financially and environmentally important. And then there's the idea of agglomeration, and which has always been somewhat important in manufacturing, but with this whole idea of innovation and technology and idea making, being able to agglomerate around others like you to be able to share things and experiment with is powerful, and that's an urban phenomenon. And then this whole idea of the maker movement, being able to do it yourself or at least be attached to the process of actually being able to make things and know how they're made is being a powerful dynamic. And again, that's a an urban sort of dynamic. And I'm getting close to my conclusions here. So to really summarize this whole 21st century thing is that urban manufacturing is going to be all about highly skilled workers. And the idea of being able to attract and retain those types of workers, you're going to need urban amenity to do it. There will be manufacturing that happens, again, that's really driven by just the bottom line approach to it, and the assembly of goods and items doesn't necessarily take as much skill. Those things might happen and more than likely will not happen in a largely urban context. But if you're talking about attracting the people who would actually be producing the stuff and having the skills to do it, you need to make environments that are compelling. And so this is really my last slide here to kind of illustrate what might be an example of a neighborhood that you could look down a street that might kind of fit this idea. We don't, again, have to separate those uses as much as we used to, but you have to have places and spaces in place to really stimulate and attract and retain those workers who are going to be involved. And they could be eating and living as well as designing and working and making. And so this is just an example of a project that my firm worked on in Victoria, British Columbia, Dockside Green. So you can see kind of physically all the elements sort of integrated into this environment is just but one example. So with that, I'm going to pass it on to the other panelists, and hopefully we'll have time to discuss these in just a few minutes.
Just make sure it's right. Okay, great. Good morning. Sorry, we had a little glitch there this morning pulling this together. But my name is Peter Remish, and I am founder and president of a real estate company called First and First. And my roots are extend back to St. Paul. I grew up in St. Paul, attended high school at Highland Park, and have spent the first 18 years of my life in the city, so I'm very familiar with it, and I've seen a lot of transformation, changes, both positive and maybe not so positive within the city, I am very personally invested in the city of St. Paul and love it in the various neighborhoods and just the dynamic nature of the urban life of St. Paul. What we do, just a moment about what we're up to, we acquire older, what I would describe as sort of like dirty, dusty, obsolete factories that have been fallen into disuse from their original intention, and then we repurpose these factories. We basically pull them apart in their entirety and then put them back together again and reimagine and reshape them in what we strive for is hopefully very dynamic and creative ways that service what we call the new generation of entrepreneurs. So I'll walk you through some of our projects here and fill you in a little bit more on some of the details. So we're in the business of transformation. That is moving new ideas forward that will benefit everyone that comes through this world, including us. Our vehicle is real estate. Not in a traditional sense, but in using spaces to create centers of culture to become living rooms of St. Paul and Minneapolis. We create inspiring places. This is an image of a project we have in northeast Minneapolis on the corner of Broadway and Central. This was an old warehouse that was used for a Landonaud mattress factory. They manufactured mattresses here for over 50 years. And for the last 30 or so years, it was used as a warehouse for paper storage. We acquired the building in 2012. It was in deplorable condition and pulled it apart and reimagined it, inverted the entrance, what was the entrance of the building to the other side of the building, and created individual tenant spaces. This is as you walk into the entryway on the second floor looking down, showing the common areas. This is a project over on Nicollet Avenue, right off Nicollet, in 26, called Ice House Plaza. This is almost a city block of a collection of about four or five buildings that we acquired back in 2010. The buildings were also in just awful condition. One of them had been condemned. One of them had the roof had collapsed. There was a building on this site right here, which is the plaza space, which we tore down because it was really beyond saving. And just a little bit about this project. We created this open-air plaza space here because the density of these buildings was so great. We felt like there was no where to breathe. You walked or you drove into the parking lot, and it was sort of like envisioning a canyon. I wanted to open it up and create more of an open-air in urban environment. So we tore that building down and created this outdoor plaza space. It is interesting. Colleagues, what have you, many people said, don't tear that building down. You're losing valuable space, and I don't disagree with that. It was valuable space, but I think some of the parts that create this whole of this plaza space, having this green space in the city amongst all this density really drove the project in a unique and dynamic way, and I felt it helped create more of a desirability for our tenants that did land here. And I just think it's sort of a unique animal to have this in a very, very dense urban area. It's open to the public. Anyone can use it. People frequent the coffee shop. There's three restaurants. There's a restaurant on the corner of Black Sheep Pizza. There's another restaurant directly behind that, Eat Street Social. The big tall building in the back is Vertical Endeavors that we converted that. That's an old ice house that was used to carve and store ice out of Cedar Lake. Kind of pre-Freon, and we converted that big brick barn into an indoor rock climbing facility for Vertical Endeavors, a St. Paul tenant that got their start here. Right over here on the right side is another restaurant called the Ice House, and right in front of that, or to the left toward this direction, is Jasmine Deli. So it's a cohesive collection of a number of all local-owned neighborhood businesses that does have a high degree of functionality, and the tapestry that this sort of has woven together is quite successful. The climbers go climb, they get hungry, they spill over into the restaurants and the bars, and it functions quite well within a neighborhood and probably created in excess of 250 to 300 new jobs. This is another project that we acquired back in 2010. This is the former home of the Theatre de la Jeune Lune, which was in Minneapolis from 1990 to 2008 and unfortunately did not make it beyond the recession. The building fell into disrepair. It was vacant. It was on the market for 2 years. We acquired the building in 2010. Not really having a crystal clear direction of what we're going to do with it. I sort of broke the cardinal rule or sin of real estate was I fell in love with the building. I've always loved the building. But it was a very, very unique animal. It's historically protected, so there's you can't have windows. You can't make any punctures in the facade. It's a Cass Gilbert facade. So we had ideated and looked at a number of different uses and concepts and finally landed on an event center because of the pressure that I was getting from friends to have their party or their wedding or their event there. I finally just sort of acquiesced and said, well, why don't we let the building be what it wants to be? So we started Aria, an event center, which has been really fast-moving and terrific. We will have an excess of 250 events there this year in 2014 and probably in excess of that next year, 2015. Again, the decadence of the architecture, the historical patina, just the uniqueness and the flavor of when you walk in there, it feels like you're not in Minneapolis. It's just been a very successful project for us and a very desirable place where people want to be and celebrate their parties, weddings, corporate events, nonprofits, etc. This slide shows you the slide that I showed you just a moment ago on Broadway and Central. This is that exact building. This is sort of what we start with. This is the platform. We start with, like, again, these buildings that have fallen into disuse and lack of maintenance and lack of everything, really. And We then go into this raw space and start looking at ideas and concepts and planning and jump into the project. This, I put the slide in here just to give you a sense of like what, you know, my generation, we grew up, our parents sometimes worked in buildings like this, glass and steel, that were very, you know, sort of exemplified the 20th, late 20th century architectural movement and how these buildings were very much a part of the success of America. The new generation of entrepreneurs we found have turned away from this and are looking at more of an urban focus and really want that decadence and brick and timber patina where they feel comfortable and it's just a place where they want to run their companies. This is a project over on Vandalia, right in the corner of Vandalia 94. This is one that has been it's a former mattress company again, about 200,000 square feet. This is sort of what it looks like, or what it looked like when we acquired the building. We are going through it right now, going through the planning and the renovation and just the various pieces to transform this to get it to where it needs to go. This is the interior space on the main floor of the 30,000 square foot building. This shows you sort of the transformation of the space and how we are using the space to recreate it, reshape it, and make it desirable to the new generation of entrepreneurs. Interior spaces up on the second floor showing sort of the artifacts, some of the things that we do to create this kind of whimsical nature, infusing art and culture into the spaces. Exterior planning showing the outdoor courtyard features. A big part of our plan is using exterior spaces to create this outdoor ambiance that gives it a life and an energy and a uniqueness and a real desirability that makes it both an interior and an exterior use and really has a flow, kind of using the definition of osmosis, diffusion of particles through a semi-permeable membrane. We use that theory to, you know, ingratiate the exterior into the interior. Where many of these buildings were built as sort of fortresses, we try to peel them back, open them up, give them more life, give them access to the exterior, and give them that flow and that energy where people can navigate between both the exterior and the interior spaces and feel like it's all cohesive and it coalesced together and it's one of the same. This is another shot showing Wabash Street. Again, we're taking the front of the building, which was Vandalia, moving it to the back of the building, which is off of Wabash in the parking lot. In the back here, the water tower will stay. This is a very big project for us. We have a lot of work to do. Yet, this spring, we'll be digging into the courtyard and the plaza spaces and opening this up and doing all the work that we need to create that infrastructure. We're very excited about the tenant and the responses that we've gotten for the spaces. We are excited because we're pulling some businesses from Minneapolis and other places over into St. Paul. The Midway area is a very desirable location. It services both cities uniquely well. We're continuing to have a tremendous amount of lease momentum and interest in the space, which is terrific. It validates our efforts, and it's sort of these milestones of lease thresholds are very important to us. As we fill it up, we need to obviously make the building economically successful. This slide just shows you sort of an overview survey of the project, Vandalia Street in front of us, Wabash on the left side there, showing the different, the plaza space between the two buildings. There'll be a craft brewer in the building right behind that, the plaza space, the Vandalia Tower. Again, it's an ecosystem that hopefully will function very well together. There'll be outdoor bike storage spaces, walkways, outdoor amenities, and then, of course, the indoor spaces that will be serving the tenants. This is a few of the new companies that have joined us and signed leases for the project. Marketing firms, the craft brewery, IFP, Independent Filmmaker Project, yoga studio. We're in conversations with dozens of various prospects. We have multiple showings every day. So again, we're trying to build upon this momentum and really make this a dynamic, viable project within the city of St. Paul. We're very proud of it. We hope to have a lot of a big push this spring, and hopefully by fall or this time next year, we should be on our kind of last chapter to finalization or completion of the project. I believe this is my last slide. Yep. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the invitation to be here today. I'm Dave Stokes. I'm with Cassidy Turley, a real estate service firm. I cut my teeth at PED. I won't say how long ago, but worked with Don and Lucy a while ago for a couple of years. I then worked at the Port Authority, tiptoeing into the private sector, worked with Lori Lauer for 10 years, and then moved into the third-party real estate service side of the business many years ago, but my business has always been predominantly Ramsey County. I've done a lot of work in my PED and Port Authority days in the Midway area and continue to do that, but kind of work the East Metro area. And I took the approach of just answering the questions I was given to. I thought I was in a class, so I'd better answer the questions and follow that. So that's what I did here. But again, thanks for the invitation. First question. What's the definition of industrial? That really is a good question because it really means different things to different people. I'll go meet with the city about doing an industrial development, and in their mind, it's what Jay put as the first slide, which is smokestacks and grease and oil and things burning coming out of it. And in my world, industrial can be a data center. It can be a heavy industrial. It can be a cross-dock. It can be warehouse, storage, manufacturing. It can be med tech. It can be clean rooms, light assembly. It can be fulfillment, which is a bigger and bigger area within the industrial world. It can be back office, data, and it can also be what we call in my world, it can be office, service, or flex space. And some of these, and I'll have a picture in a little bit, sometimes what the real estate world calls industrial is really maybe an 80% office finish. So when somebody says industrial, you need to say, what are we really talking about? Here's just two examples of what are industrial. 443 Fillmore, a cross dock down by the St. Paul Airport. I did some leasing on that, older building. It's industrial. Energy Park Corporate Center, I think Port Authority did this years ago with Ryan. Kemp's is there now. We call that an industrial building, but it's really 80% office and is a corporate headquarters site. And it's all industrial. On the question of what types of businesses are attracted to urban industrial locations, I broke this up into two different categories. There's new construction, and then there's repositioning of existing buildings. And you've heard a little bit about that from others as far as repositioning. I'll say Peter is one that does an excellent job of that with his projects. In the new construction area, I'll just say there's strong demand for new construction inside the loop, the 694, 494 loop. Three buildings are going up right now in Roseville. In St. Paul, you've got St. Paul Port Authority projects with Interstate Partners at Beacon Bluff, Wellington's, I think it's phase four for their River Bend, and their proposed project where the port is partnering with United Properties in the Midway area. So there is demand for land, and here's just two examples. Wellington's in the lower right, the River Bend, and then the proposed new development with the port and United Properties on the former St. Paul Saints site. And there's also other projects under completion. We can talk about what's attracted. John Allen completed his Meridian project in the Midway area. That's 100% leased four tenants, and one of them is called Trinity 3 Technologies, which is a computer refurbishing firm, just to give you the kind of firms that are attracted into this area. Another tenant is Salsalisa, who has been in St. Paul for a while, was in another Midway location. So it's a real range of kinds of businesses that are attracted, but I don't want to overstate the firm, the line. If you build it, they will come for quality developments. There's good demand. And tenants are attracted to areas based on access to markets and labor. And I'll say that the urban market doesn't really compete with the suburban market. So if somebody's looking to Rogers for a new distribution center, you're not competing with them. They're going to go to, maybe it's Otsego, maybe it's Rogers, maybe it's Shakopee. But they're not going to be looking to Minneapolis or St. Paul or Roseville. On the flip side, the businesses that want to be here, it's for a reason, and you're not competing with that suburban market. And then on the other side, on the repositioning of existing buildings that get attracted to industrial areas, all those repositionings don't end up being industrial. Older, lower clear height buildings are no longer functional for the modern manufacturing or distribution firms. And this has led to a lot of conversions of older buildings. And I've got a couple of examples here, although I have to say Peter's redevelopment is one of the better ones. But, and this is just from me driving around. I live in St. Paul. I work in the Midway area. This is just pictures, examples. 2520 Como used to be Quality Park Products, an envelope manufacturing company, is now a self-storage facility. I'm not saying it's the best use, but that's what happens to some industrial buildings. Former McGill Jensen Bonta building, 330,000 square foot building. I represented them years ago and sold it to a church. And I think that Jay or John mentioned about the changes in the printing industry. It's been huge and dramatic, and there's future opportunities in that industry, but it's a world that's changing quickly, and those older, low clear height buildings are finding different purposes. And then the third one is, I think, a great redevelopment that Goodwill did years and years ago in the Midway area. And for those of us that have been around a while like me, that was the former RC Cola plant. But again, they took a bottling plant, turned it into really retail warehouse and offices. So you get a variety of reuses in these older buildings. Next question was, is the market for industrial uses and sites changing? And I'd say yes, and it's a huge shift in the last 10 years. And with that, I just want to give you just a 30-second update on the industrial market in general. And after the Great Recession, when there was contraction in all industrial sectors, or really all sectors, we've really seen a lot of growth in the industrial sector the last couple of years. And the slide on the right, those bars show absorption, and a normal market would be maybe 2%. You can see the left half of it was negative absorption or contraction. And then really starting in 2012, we had a huge boom. It slackened off a little bit in 13, but it's back up with big, big absorption these last couple of quarters, and we think that'll continue for a bit. The slide on the right, overall vacancy, historic average, 12.5%. That's that dotted yellow line. But you can see vacancy has gone down significantly since 2011, and that's what's led to all the new development that we're seeing. New developments are coming out of the ground quickly because of this demand, and in particular, the bulk industrial market is booming, especially in the northwest and southwest. So Otsego, Rogers, spots I hadn't thought much about 15 years ago. If you drive out there, it's stunning, the large new industrial buildings that are going up out there. Industrial in this case meaning 32-foot clear bulk type buildings. But there is demand in the inside the loop if you can find the dirt. And here's some examples. These pictures were all taken on one day, maybe 4 weeks ago, and just showing this is Highcrest in Roseville, 3075 Long Lake in Roseville. They're about a mile apart. Northern Stacks in Fridley, and then a couple other buildings. But one shows you this is what new industrial buildings look like. And if you can find a piece of dirt to put them on, they will get built. These two in Roseville, and I use them as an example just because it's close to St. Paul, they had plans to reposition those buildings for a long time, finally gave up on a more dense vision. As soon as they tore down the building and redeveloped it, they were able to build these buildings. I'll say what is changing. Well, here's what is not changing in the industrial world. Buildings still have to have adequate employee parking. This is actually increasing as industrial buildings start having more fulfillment activities in them. So you have to have parking, and you need adequate truck access, truck courts, and dock doors. I know it's not sexy to talk about those kinds of things, but it's really the basic infrastructure that supports these kinds of buildings and the kind of businesses and employees that want to be in them. I joke with my family at home, I saw a building that had 32 dock doors, and they go, your business is so boring. I said, no, that's what drives everything. It's exciting stuff. They don't agree. You also need larger sites as buildings get bigger, and you just need to keep a separation of truck traffic from employee and visitor parking, and you need, obviously, good freeway access. So those are just some of the basics that have been around and will continue to be around. Next question, are there new building prototypes emerging? And again, definitely big changes. Years ago, 18-foot clear height, and the height of the building is kind of the driver of things. That was modern. Then it moved up to 24 feet. Now it's 32 feet. Some buildings are even going to 40 feet. It's all about cubic volume. And also, buildings are getting bigger. In the Twin Cities, 10 years ago, a big building was 250,000 square feet, kind of like the Bonta building. Nowadays, buildings are 400 and 800,000 square feet. It's just, they've just gotten a lot bigger. And examples are Uline built a 680,000 square foot building in Hudson, Wisconsin. We work with a group called Sandmar that built a 580,000 square foot building 2 years ago in Shakopee. Again, these are all twice as big as they were even 10 years ago. And with these changes, you need bigger and bigger sites to accommodate all of this. There's so much change, we've even changed some of our terminology. We used to call it modern, traditional warehouse are these older, lower clear ones. Modern are these higher clear buildings. So there's a lot of segments in the industrial market. And then to this slide, there's a lot of demand for flex space. And flex space, we also call office service, office showroom. It's a building like Westgate in the upper left-hand corner, and then University Crossing. These are both in the Midway, where they're, we call them industrial, but they're maybe 50, 70, 80% office finish. There's been good demand for that. The University Crossing is filled with med tech healthcare companies and is 100% leased. So, it kind of, again, the kind of users that come into these markets. And then the last question is just, was how do you increase job density and living wages and the public sector's role? I think as the city is already doing, revising the definition of industrial to be more than manufacturing and more specific to each of the uses and activities. And I think especially in the West Midway, every block has a different character, and that's where you get the conflicts and the opportunities. But what's on University is different than two blocks off of University versus six blocks, and how you zone that is the work to be done. I just also break things into three areas. I think let some older buildings transition to new uses if they can, as Peter has done. And again, bottom right, used to be Moline Manufacturing on Highway 280, is now a semi-retail building redeveloped by Bob Salmon. Remley Engineering, this is on Pierce Butler, used to be a manufacturing high-precision company. Now it's Star Ocean Foods, a food distribution firm. So just so you see what is going on, so certain buildings can get reused. I'd say there's some buildings that you need to let go and let them be torn down. I don't have pictures of these, but the Diamond Products building that got torn down for the St. Paul Saints, I worked with that broker for years to market that. You're not. That was something that wasn't ever going to get repositioned. There's parts of Beacon Bluff, the old 3M campus. I worked on that on marketing some of those older, low-clear, two-story manufacturing buildings. There's just some buildings that are not going to find a new home, and you got to let them go so you can do something else better with them. And then the third direction is finding land for new industrial development, and that's where it's what is that industrial? It can be a lot of different things. Again, data centers, technology, still some upper right-hand corner, some more typical modern buildings, but finding sites for new new developments. So with that, thank you.
Well, good morning. I feel like this maybe should be the seventh inning stretch or something. Everyone should get up and do a couple of jumping jacks, whatever. I bet y'all been here for a while. Anyway, thanks for inviting me. I'm really honored to be here, and I really was looking forward to the presentations from the other folks here. And I'm so glad David answered all the questions because I wasn't planning to answer the questions. But I'm happy to take questions if you have any. My name is John Wall. The company, my company is the Wall Company. It's actually a second-generation real estate development company. We have a number of ties to St. Paul. A lot of our work has been in St. Paul and in Minneapolis. Our family also owns the Highland Bank, located in St. Paul. I'm here today mostly to talk to you about one particular project, and we've done, you know, hotels and apartments and condos and all kinds of different projects around the Twin Cities. This particular project I'm most excited about, we call the Minnesota Innovation Park. And the idea came to us long ago when I hired a guy who said, you know, John, I got a great project for you. It's to develop a science park or a university-related science park. And you set it up right across the street from the University of Minnesota so that private companies, private, public, you know, all kinds of companies can set up shop across the street from the university and help to commercialize some of the cutting-edge research that goes on at the University of Minnesota. And I was further inspired by this by a couple years later, we joined the Association for University Research Parks. Who'd have thought? An association. So anyway, we're traveling around the country to different parts of the different science parks around the country, and the people kept asking me, you know, so you're from Minnesota? With this really quizzical, you know, look on their face. I'm like, well, yeah, the University of Minnesota, Minnesota? I'm like, yeah. Well, how is it possible the University of Minnesota, being one of the most, you know, nationally recognized research universities, has no science park? I mean, they receive and spend, you know, $700-800 million a year on research at the university. And where does that go? What do they do with that? I mean, in my mind, and humble or uninformed maybe as I am, I would think all that research might eventually spill out into the community, and it might help create new jobs and new technologies and new devices and new drugs and new all the things that they're working on. So with that in mind, we ran across the street from the university. We bought a whole bunch of land. We got about 20 acres over there now. And our plan is to develop the new generation of warehouse buildings, or actually going back further to John's comments, and John had a picture there at the end of one of our old manufacturing or warehouse buildings, which is a grain elevator, to convert that area into a new generation, a new industry of innovation, which Jay mentioned. Anyway, so we're referring to this as the Minnesota Innovation Park. The idea, I guess I've kind of jumped ahead a little bit, is to create an ecology. So that was the whole idea of ecology is something that, as a real estate developer, took a little bit of thinking. In other words, why would someone go there? I mean, just because the university's there doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, the university's always been there. You know, there's no reason to build a park since the university's already been there. But if you create an ecology and you bring people that have either ties to the university or they're vendors or service providers that can help companies, you know, to create this sense of place, that would really help develop the whole park. Obviously, to become a driver of collaboration with the industry and government and academia, to create a broader ecology of innovation, and to establish a living laboratory for sustainability. Now, the sustainability part is obviously an important component in all of new buildings. I mean, every new building, from you know Peter's work to some of conversions of older buildings are striving for higher efficiency, energy efficiency, better efficient use of the space, better technology. So we're hoping that this new park will be a place to showcase those new innovation ideals. So then when you look at the park, you think, well, who do you want? I mean, it could be anybody, really. Well, maybe what we should do is focus on four centers of excellence, four particular areas of strength that we think we do well already, and if we could bring people together in these industries along with academia, that they could do even better. And then to bring them to make these centers of excellence and put four of them next to one another, now you have a chance that they can kind of work together. So, for example, our first center of excellence is the medical technologies and life science. Second one, green energy and clean technologies. Third is food science. And the fourth is high technology and robotics. And there's a lot of different fields that kind of fit in those categories. But imagine, if you will, if you're successful in developing a really strong medical or life sciences center of excellence and you put it next to the clean energy folks. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, kind of overlapping technologies that could be developed by their just mere proximity. We also look at, so who would the tenants be? I mean, I think of some of the bigger companies, like in life science, you think maybe Medtronic or Guidant or St. Jude. But they already have a corporate headquarters. I mean, they're not likely to move their corporate headquarters over there. But what they might do is they might set up a satellite post there where they can bring in, say they acquire a new company or they want to do some sponsored research at or across the street from the university where they bring faculty and students over. That would help on the research side. It would also help on the just the simple HR or the hiring side. You know, you want to train students and faculty to do things that you might one day actually hire them to come into the company. So we've looked at a variety of different types of tenants. And I mentioned the ecology inside this, aside from having just companies, we'd like to see, you know, places like the Maker's Lab and the Innovation Bench, a variety of different service providers. I won't read them all to you here, but this is the location that we have now. And I realize we're in Minneapolis and I'm now in St. Paul. I'm getting to that part. But you should know where we are because it's a stone's throw away from St. Paul. You see the TCF Stadium there up in the upper left. And we're basically at the St. Paul border on the right. So we've been working on this project for a little while, and the neighborhood, we spent a fair amount of time with the neighborhood, and they've said, you know, John, we'd like to work with you to help build this new, you know, the place around the new light rail station that we have. And I said, well, that's great, because that's, you know, we're right there, right on 29th Street. We have a light rail, new light rail station right there. So they said, well, what can we do to help you? And I said, you know, one of the things that has always sort of made me self-conscious, I guess, or whatever, is I attend these AURP meetings around the country, the big science parks, you know, and many of them are household names. And I think if we were wildly successful in our little 20-acre parcel here, we'd still be a, you know, doinky little research park in a bigger picture. But, you know, if we could expand this, if we could brand this about innovation and collaboration and make it a bigger project, it would be I think more successful, and it would be something that both the city of Minneapolis and the city of St. Paul, Hennepin and Ramsey County, and the whole state could really get around branding of a new place, as John mentioned. I'm going to kind of skip ahead over that. So we proposed to make it bigger. And we don't own any of this land, but we decided, well, we started, we didn't own the land anyway, so that isn't going to stop us. But if we took our little chalk line and we went beyond the area where we already own, which is right in here, and we went over to the west and got this biodiscovery zone area that the state and the university already spent hundreds of millions of dollars on cutting edge science buildings, which as a little diversion, when I was asked from these folks at the AURP meetings what's going on in Minnesota, I went over to the U and I said, you know, you got to give me an answer. But people are asking me, where's all this money going? Why isn't there more collaboration between the university? And one of the answers was, well, we do at the university more sort of basic research, which is one end of the spectrum, where the other end is more applied research. So if you're going to develop something, it's more likely to come out on the applied side. And they said, you know, quite frankly, we recognize that as an issue. And as a university, we really need to do more on the applied side of the spectrum to take our basic research and push it out towards the door where a company might want to work with us. They might commercialize something we've developed. So that is, in large part, the impetus for this biodiscovery zone is to go more to the applied side. So that for us, that's wonderful, because what a great engine of innovation is coming out of this area here. We've got our park project developing here. And then you look at the rest of this. Here's the St. Paul-Minneapolis boundary. And you've got Westgate, as Dave mentioned, just a, you know, chock-a-block full of life science and health companies. Perfect, the perfect kinds of tenants we'd like to see in an innovation park. And then, unfortunately, I don't really know who owns all this down here, so I can insult them freely. their property is, you know, is just as kind of junky as our stuff is up here, and which is a great opportunity for bringing old manufacturing into the new economy. So I just think of this whole area here, not just 20 acres, but now 270 acres of a new Minnesota Innovation Park. Well, we went to the neighbors.
It's two cities.
Can you help me change this really quick? We went to the neighbors, and we've kind of changed the terminology a little bit. We're now looking more at calling it a Minnesota Innovation District. Term seems to have been more acceptable. So I'll use the terms kind of interchangeably. And the neighborhood has developed, and John helped us with this too, this Prospect North Partnership. And I've been a strong proponent to say, you know, I know you guys really want to focus on the 29th Street Light Rail Station, but if you look at this larger area, we have three light rail stations. And it was just a tremendous opportunity to work together, the two cities, to work together to redevelop, you know, areas that parts of which are sorely in need of redevelopment. So we've been working with Krauss Anderson and RSP Architects to help us come up with some of the images and the design for the center. Let's see, Minnesota Innovation Park, the partnership, and the University of Minnesota. So Here's another image of kind of where we are, the blue area being the Innovation District, the Minneapolis campus on the west side and downtown, and I'm sorry, I don't know how we put the St. Paul campus up there. It's really over to the right, but it's intended to be on there on purpose because, quite frankly, this is the gateway between the two campuses, and if what works in Minneapolis to help develop and commercialize new product, the same can be said about St. Paul. Obviously, I mentioned the three light rail district, light rail stations. We actually have light rail stations going through that whole area. And I'm sorry, this slide is too small to really read, but this kind of highlights all of the features that are really pertinent to the Innovation District. A lot of the different tenants that are appropriate for this kind of park. And I guess just as a little sideline, today is kind of a auspicious day for us. Right about now, actually, the grand opening for the new Surly Brewery is taking place, mm-hmm. which is right across the street from our park right here. So I hope you get a chance to stop over there.
And is it true, John, that they're using St. Paul water in their operations?
You know, if they want the best beer, I'm sure that they are. So, so we put together an image for what we want to see on the park here now, and of course we've got a little work to go on it. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting is the neighborhood came to us and said, "John, you know, you got a couple of grain elevators over there, and I sure hope you're not going to tear them down." And when I realized they weren't joking, I said, "Well, okay, you got to help me figure out what in the world could we possibly do with those grain elevators? Because as much as I admire Peter's work in adaptive reuse, I cannot for the life of me think of what to do with those grain elevators." Well, they come back with a couple of, I think, interesting ideas, and the first one was, "Well, why don't you put the Bell Museum on the roof of the big grain elevator?" Mm-hmm. I thought, "Oh, okay, you can get that done." And well, it turns out it's too late. They're already going to St. Paul on the St. Paul campus. But it does say, you know, well, you could put a building on the roof, and it could be really kind of a unique and special place because you don't get a view like that, for one. It's right at the light rail station, and the building could be maintained as an icon for the history and the heritage of the Twin Cities. So till we figure out that's not going to work, we're going with that. I did call the contractor, and the contractor said, "We've got to call the engineer." I called the engineer, and they said, I said, "You know, if I built on the roof, would the building, you know, handle that?" And he said, "You know, the way those things are built, you could build a skyscraper on the roof, so you don't have to worry about that." But anyway, but the general outline here is to build about 500,000 square feet on the 20 acres that we have here of, you know, mostly office, laboratory, light manufacturing, some retail, and some kind of gathering space. We have a building down here in the center. We're hopeful that we can keep. It's a kind of an old barn kind of building that we might make into more of a public, kind of a public space, and a plaza around the front. Plaza coming from the light rail station down here, right in this area here. So I think that's really about all I got here for my presentation. I'm working hard to bring this kind of over into St. Paul, and I hope you'll support that effort, and B, you'll be a little patient because it's a pretty good sized group and we're working through a lot of things. But I think in the end, if we can make this a Minneapolis and St. Paul combined effort, it'll be a wonderful project we can all be proud of. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, John. Thank you to each of the panelists. Really interesting presentations. I think you know, we've got a little over 30 minutes to have some discussion, and I feel like with the raw material that's been presented this morning, we could have a lot longer conversation than that. But I'd like to ask a question, maybe put the panelists on the spot a little bit, and then ideally open it up to to commissioners' comments and questions. But my question is really related to the work that the commission is charged with doing as essentially the primary land use regulator in the city. The recommendations that come out of this body are a really critical piece in terms of city policy around land use. And we've heard this morning about a couple of different overall strategies for the handling of industrial land and buildings in the city. One is, you know, repositioning buildings that have, you know, are built with materials that are incredibly durable, old growth timber and brick, et cetera, repositioning those for a new generation of users and a future life. Dave, you mentioned the strategy of these very large structures, 400,000 to 800,000 foot structures that are being developed elsewhere in the region. That's clearly a market impulse, achieving those kinds of economies of scale. And then there's another model which has been demonstrated in the city, which is the Port Authority's model, which I view as really a third approach. And I'm wondering if the panelists would be willing to comment on how do you advise the Planning Commission about how to navigate those three choices, or if there are others? You know, what's your advice in terms of the Commission's next steps, thinking about the comprehensive plan for the city and how that flows into zoning? What's your recommendation for local decision makers who really need to be planning at the site level and at the district level and the city level for the future of industry?
I'll jump in and start. When I talked about the big buildings being built, these 400, 800,000 square foot buildings, I don't think there's a place for those in St. Paul or that there needs to be, but I think it's important just to see that's a part of the industrial market that isn't going to be in St. Paul, which is fine, but it is a major activity that changes distribution, how people buy, how they happen in those buildings. But I do think there's a role for adaptive reuse of certain buildings, and then again, some you need to tear down, and maybe there's going to be arguments over are they worth saving, can they be reused or not. But I think that the Port Authority's model of sites for owner-user businesses, you know, where a business buys and builds a building is good, and then the medium-sized industrial buildings like the United, some of the projects they're doing now where they're not too big, they're not too small, but there's a market for those, and they can be tenants or users in those buildings.
I'll add to David's comment, and I'll say that I think it's a little bit of what Peter's examples of the work that he's been doing at a site level has to go to sort of a district level. And I'm saying that from the standpoint of I'm looking at sort of urban industrialism and it being dominated by innovators and sort of highly trained and skilled folks. And they're in sort of an urban environment for a reason. And that, you know, as I said in my discussion, it's about amenity of experience and place. It's not just in the actual workshop, but it's in the neighborhood and around them. I don't think a high level of amenity, urban amenity in the public realm needs to be everywhere in the districts, but there will need to be key points within these districts. I don't know if it's every several blocks where there's something of interest that folks see that there's amenity there. So that when, you know, maybe then they come down from the workshop and maybe the street that the building on isn't pristine and made to some, you know, huge server urban, you know, kind of nirvana, but they can walk a block and they're into some spot or node that's got some value to them.
Yeah, I'll jump in. I guess I would say it's hard for me to like sort of encompass like a wholesale solution. I think it's really a case by case scenario on as the buildings that are centered around the community, each one needs to be evaluated for what its potential future use might be or might not be, whether it's going to be removed or whether it can be repurposed. Repurposing these buildings is extraordinarily difficult. We come up against things that no one could ever know going into it. At the same time, you know, to create a vibrant and dynamic urban culture, I think, you know, in my mind, the preservation of these, you know, brick and timber and interesting architectural buildings that sort of, you know, dot the landscape of our community is a very important thing to be doing. I think, you know, there may be perhaps incentives or maybe other ways to help sort of move this type of work forward, but in my mind, that is what the future, the new generation of youth coming up into the world, the focus on urban from suburban, the new generation of entrepreneurs, where they want to be. These are dialogues that we're having every single day, and I think that it's a really critical piece to the vitality and the dynamic nature or lack thereof of any community. So some of these buildings are not that interesting. They're maybe not worth saving. Many of them are. I think it's a case-by-case basis where you're looking at the overall lay of land and the neighborhood and the community and sort of making that point of determination what would be the best fit in this scenario. Mm-hmm. And it's really difficult as a planning commission, I think, to sort of layer that lens onto the private development community. Many of these projects are driven by economics. Many developers, I think, would, you know, recoil to say, well, we can't do that. It doesn't make economic sense. I think there's a balance there. There's something that, you know, hopefully it's a dialogue, and hopefully, you know, the best idea does sort of emerge. Is that an answer?
It sure
didn't
is.
Feel like one.
It sure is. Thanks.
I think it's an interesting dilemma myself. The project we're working on over in just off of Malcolm there has had almost all the projects right around us are industrial converting to housing. And if I were a planning commissioner or a council member, I would be a little anxious about seeing all my industrial go into housing. Matter of fact, as a developer of housing, it's been quite tempting to consider doing the same on our project, since there's four of them basically across the street from us that are going to housing. But I think it's really important to maintain some mix to keep jobs in the neighborhood, you know, because, you know, that it just makes, I think, for a better community. So I think it's an interesting balance. So on the one hand, I'm saying don't let all the industrial go away. On the other hand, I'm fighting a row of semi-trucks going by our building, which I don't know if that's the highest and best use of the industrial use either. So, I mean, I think there's kind of tempering on both ends. Personally, I like to see some of the, you know, the cargo container storage lots and that kind of stuff go somewhere else. But I'd hate to see the industrial go away as a whole, because I think industrial, commercial, office, in that whole category, you want to have a place where people work, not just live.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, let's open it up. Trevor.
And that actually segued into the question I wanted to ask, which is, last century or so, we've been putting uses in boxes and trying to figure out who's not compatible with them. A lot of that's not been such great work and done, but the question I have is, given who is looking at the city for what we're now calling industrial development, what are the incompatible uses? I mean, assuming you have your choice of places that have the amenities, transportation, and things like that, what are the types of tenants that drive away the types of folks that we're talking about? Or are there?
So, Trevor, are you asking about who are the current users who would be potentially driven away by evolving trends, or?
No, I'm not that. What I'm asking more is, you know, say currently someone who wants a clean room is not going to want to set up shop next to a rock crushing operation. And what are the new compatibilities that we haven't thought about? Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. So question is, what are the incompatibilities that are sort of unique to the evolving market landscape as opposed to the last generation of incompatibilities.
Because we've really codified the last generation. That's what's in our zoning now. And I think that's a lot of the discussion we had on West Midway and others is what are these new mm-hmm. incompatibilities and what do we need to do to modernize that so that it's not an impediment itself to more creative approaches.
I'll weigh on this. I'm going to try to take a stab at it. I think the historic issues of smell, sound, particulate matter being spewed into the, you know, in the air. I mean, all that stuff's going to still continue to be an issue. So if there are nearby uses that have those conflicts, you know, it doesn't matter if it's 19th century activity or 22nd century activity, it's still going to be a problem. Where I see kind of the whole modern issue perhaps coming up that we haven't experienced before, and we haven't, you know, maybe had a way to deal with it before, is that if there's perhaps an innovation district or a green district or a sustainability district that's really driven by the idea that all those uses in there are somehow working kind of as part of a symbiotic system, and they're all benefiting from achieving some level of greenness or sustainability or whatever standard, then there becomes an issue of, oh wait, we've got somebody in here who's not at that standard, and they're compromising the vision of the district, and B, they're actually eating more energy, or they're doing something on some level that's not to the standards that everybody agrees on. That's kind of my guess. I don't know if anybody else has a.
And Jay, in your view, is it the city's role, sort of evolving role, to quantify or sort of measure that symbiosis and define whether that's in place here or there or not? I mean, the question becomes, is that sort of the next generation of land use controls? Is that kind of what you're contemplating?
I think so. I think there's a lot of potential there. To start to develop tools that are based in sort of research. Obviously you have to update what happens with those tools if you're going to be looking at data to help back up. But I think there's some definite possibilities that there's ways to identify what acceptable standards are.
I just add to that, where it gets more complicated is places like the BNSF yard in the Midway area. Some you get noise, vibrations. Some things are not going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so how do you, that's your big challenge, how do you deal with all those transitions? Again, it's block by block, because some things you can hope eventually go away by zoning changes, which is good, but some are going to be there, and then how do you just say, okay, because then there's businesses that want to be around that hub and their trucking, and that's not real compatible with other things. So how do you, I'm answering it with a harder question, but how do you make those things tie together, and it's tough.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Dave. I would say, the sort of the functionality of these varying uses that we're discussing, I think there's been like a shake up and a shake out within traditional industries, and I think maybe even post 2008, when all these free agents were sort of spewed out into the world and had left their jobs either voluntarily or otherwise, and were converted to starting their own businesses or enterprises. I think that the creative class is sort of what we characterize it as. That's a very big umbrella, and it encompasses many, many different industries. In terms of like a traditional sense of an artist, we don't really have a lot of artist studios, but we have people that we feel that they are artists as in their creativity, and they're taking ideas and pushing those ideas forward into the world. Technologists, food artisans, craft brewers, marketing folks. So there's just a very large category of what I would call new economy jobs and industries that maybe they existed, but they didn't exist in this fashion today that they did maybe 5 years or 10 years ago. Our Vandalia project, we've set up shop there across the street from the paper company, Peckel, facility, which is 500 jobs, very, very heavy industrial use. If I would have told somebody that a yoga studio is going in there, a couple of years ago, they would have laughed at me. But I think, we are hopefully going to create this very successful, dynamic oasis directly, 50 feet away from the front door of that building. And in a way, it creates kind of an interesting and dynamic tension, both, kind of a hot-cold reality between those two uses, where, again, these younger entrepreneurs and users, customers, they enjoy that tension. They enjoy that dynamic nature of a heavy industrial use juxtaposed against what we're up to across the street. People maybe in the older generations, maybe they're not as responsive to it. I don't know. I don't know if that's even true, because we did the same thing over Northeast at Broadway and Central and Nicollet, and we get a varying degree, wide range of ages that use those facilities on a daily basis. So I think it's a rethinking and a reconcepting and a re-engineering, social engineering of how we use spaces and what our urban community looks like. And it doesn't look like it did 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
I wonder, we've got representatives of our important industrial development partner, the Port Authority, here. I don't know if you want to make any comments, Louis or Lori, about what you've heard so far.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm the president of the St. Paul Port Authority. This was one of the handouts. Donna, did you get this out to everyone? I think this has been a fabulous discussion. The panelists have done a wonderful job. There's some themes. There's some really, I think, very consistent themes here. The Port Authority, a couple of years ago, put together a study with the Initiative for Competitive Inner Cities, ICIC, out of Boston, to study the industrial space in St. Paul and to talk about its challenges and opportunities. And we put together a series of outreach presentations on that. And I know that Lori's been here in front of the Planning Commission and done that report. It might be time to for her to come back and do it again. But this thing that was sent out here just a week or so ago was spectacular. This comes out of the APA, the American Planning Association, the organization that thinks big thoughts on behalf of planners and planning commissioners across the country. The consistency of theme between this, the Port Authority's ICIC work, and the conversation that you heard here today is really quite remarkable. First and foremost, modern industry is not our grandfather's industry. Jay talked about that. Modern industry provides great job diversity. John Wall talked about that. That's in here. That was in the Port's ICIC stuff. David talked about form follows function, that industrial buildings are what they are and look like the way they look and are configured on properties the way they are because form follows function for industrial activities. That was in our ICIC report. It's in this new document from the APA. It talks about the desirability of retaining industrial zoned land in the core cities. We talk about that in ICIC. It shows up here. It shows up again in the conversation from your panelists. And one of the things that hasn't been talked about a whole bunch is the incredible tax base that industrial businesses provide. And the relationship between land use, city revenues, and city expenditures. The industrial tax base in St. Paul, for every buck it sends to the city of St. Paul, it will use 60 to 70 cents in services. In other words, major net gain for the corporate entity, the financial corporate entity that the city of St. Paul is. These guys touch on it a little. ICIC touched on it a lot. I haven't heard that yet from the panelists, But if you haven't had a chance to read this, Donna, thank you very much for sending this our way. It provides some real clear ideas, some real clear direction that if you read it, you will see things that these guys all talked about, and you'll see things that showed up in our ICIC report. So this is wonderful work, great conversation. I very much, John, very much appreciate the opportunity to advise you.
Thank you. Yes.
Yes. And we did get it, Louie. And it's good reading. Thank you. My question, I was really intrigued with the innovation district. And as you look at that, and I think it's brilliant to connect with the University of Minnesota. It seems like a no-brainer. But looking at the viability, you have your redevelopment costs and then the tenants that you hope to attract, startup funds, build-out funds, all the financing that goes along with it, and then the skilled workers. Have you done that level of drill-down market analysis to make sure that you'll be successful in that development?
Well, thank you for the question. The development contemplates a spectrum of different types of buildings and therefore costs involved. I think there will be there's a good case for much of that just in normal market, you know, forces. There part of the development will probably require some assistance through whatever tools are available. I think tax increment financing seems to be a popular tool today to try and help overcome some of the costs for a portion of the development. Demolition costs, environmental remediation are some of the bigger ones that we're going to have to overcome. But on the upside, I think if you look at the potential for, you know, land that is almost no taxes now to be create something new and vibrant with the density of workers there, you can make a really strong case for, for tax increment financing or that kind of help to justify that new development.
Thank you.
Yes, Dan.
Thanks, John. Say thanks to all the speakers. I think this was really great. These were tremendous. Tremendous and very informative and certainly have my juices. I have a ton of questions, but I know we're limited on time, so I'll limit that. And by the way, Jay does very good market research, similar to what Commissioner DeJoy was talking about. Just a little plug for you, Jay. I know that.
Thanks, Dan.
Actually, my question is for Peter specifically. You know, the type of work, you know, the repurposing of buildings is the sort of thing that we would, you know, we love to see more of that in St. Paul because we've got a lot of buildings like that certainly could use repurposing. And we'd like to maintain these, you know, industrial uses as Louis was talking about. And so the question I have is, as a developer, as a real estate person, what do you look at? What are the factors that are your decision factors to say, this site is a good site where I would like to repurpose it? I see these opportunities, these possibilities, versus this site, these are the challenges I would see. This is why I, you know, would not want to go here. You know, I'm just thinking in terms of us as a planning commission thinking about how you know we look at these different sites and what are the possibilities. What do you look at as a
sure
person that's
doing it? Yeah, I think it's a combination of a couple of different things. Some of the fundamentals that are just inherently obvious are, you know, location, strength of location, access to transportation, street frontage, visibility, presence on the street, parking, the neighborhood. And certainly we don't mind being sort of early into a neighborhood. Part of our model is, it's really challenging. I mean, acquiring these buildings sometimes, the price of free gets very expensive, and we've not bought any for free yet. But it's really important to be able to, you know, get into the project at what appears to be the right price, and then go from there in the revision and repurposing of the project. But a big factor is just the overall look and feel and ambiance of the structure. Brick and timber is something that's very desirable to us. The architecture, you know, buildings that were built 100 years ago have these very, many of them have these very interesting architectural amenities that don't exist today because it's just cost prohibitive. We try to preserve those to the extent that we can and work with what we have and, like I said earlier, pull it apart and then put it back together again and hopefully what is turns out the end result is a new and dynamic use. So, you know, I think those fundamentals are probably pretty applicable to the other panelists. I think they would agree that there's a those are the strength of those fundamentals are really important. To have a project without parking, I think, is really challenging. To have a project or to go in and repurpose a building that's just a maybe an ordinary, you know, block building that was built, you know, mid-century and is not interesting also can be challenging to try to make that interesting. So, you know, there's just a lot of things that we try to seek out that hopefully create this. We walk in and we look at what we've got and we say we can do something with this. And if we can't, it shows up pretty quickly. Like, you know, we don't spend weeks or months kind of vacillating whether or not this is going to be something that we can work with or not. So, hope that answers your question. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more question. So, Terry?
Well, no, I mean, I appreciate, thank you, and I don't know if this is a bigger question, but as we talk about kind of the new highly skilled workforce that'll be coming in, I wonder if there are any efforts in the obviously very glaring disparities we have here in the Twin Cities, particularly with communities of color and at the education level. I'm wondering what are some opportunities and how we can get, you know, maybe this is the right time for our public-private partnership to do a lot of that workforce development around highly skilled. And I'm just wondering if there, you know, how, and the biggest question we always have from those who are doing this work is how do we get private sector folks? I mean, you all see the added value of why we need this to happen. What else more could we be doing? Could we be changing the narrative of that we have to grow our own? Because I see this thing about amenities is always like bringing in outside people, and I just don't think that's the case. We have people here in St. Paul who could be doing this type of work. So help me, I don't know, understand what are ways we can start to build and move on this, especially in the work that you're doing.
And Terry, can I just clarify? Yeah. You mean that in terms of St. Paul-based developers and investors, you know, being lifted up in that sense? Or are you talking more about a workforce strategy as part of the Planning Commission's body of work?
Well, I don't know. The latter part, I'm not quite sure, but the latter part we can discuss later. But it is more the former part and how, about getting them involved.
So is that, for me, that seems in part a question of how do you do a more effective job messaging the work that's already happening in the city at the hands of St. Paul residents, to me? I don't know if panelists have other thoughts about, you know, how do you also on the other end do a more effective job transmitting what the opportunities are so that there are more hands involved in the engagement of those opportunities. That seems also part of it. But if there are comments on that point.
I jump in here. Our efforts to develop our Minnesota Innovation Park, we have asked for help from a group we call our Board of Advisors, and one of our advisors he works for Stratasys, and I was really interested to learn. He said, you know, we could sell machines much faster if we could only tell people how to find people to run them. Mm-hmm. That's one of their biggest hurdles. Matter of fact, one of their biggest efforts now is to find out how to train workers to run these things. I mean, it's not that complicated, but if you buy one and you don't know how to use it, it isn't really worth much. So I would see that's a potential opportunity to jump in and say, we're going to do some workforce development, and we're going to pick, you know, additive printing or 3D printing as a field and then just make that available to the companies. I'm sure there are other fields like that too, but that one kind of jumps out at me.
You know, if I can also make a comment about that, in the last iteration of comp planning, we had a fair amount of conversation about the prospect of a human capital chapter in the comp plan. And I think, just to editorialize for a moment, I think that this round, that could be as critical or even a huge, you know, a more significant opportunity than it was 10 years ago. And the reality is that we have some opportunities to hold up St. Paul's workforce. You know, we're not where we need to be yet, in part for the reasons you described, that there's disparities that we're struggling to address. But I think having the Planning Commission's hands and eyes right on that topic as part of the more physical-based portfolio of work, I think would be really valuable. So we're at 11:30. I'm kind of shocked that this has gone by so quickly. But I really want to say thank you very much to each of our four panelists. It's been really an interesting interesting event discussion. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Lucy? Well, I thought that was interesting. I wish we would have had more time.